Beers with Chad.
Hey everybody, what's up? Chad Wesley Smith here. Another episode of Beers with Chad. Today, I'm drinking from a local Costa Mesa, Orange County, Green Cheek beer, the Always Rushing, Always Late Hazy IPA. Cheers. This place is great. One of the best burgers I've ever had, so go check them out. And I talk with my friend Corey Schlesinger. Corey is the head strength coach for the Phoenix Suns. He was previously head at Stanford men's basketball and is a previous Jug Life guest. So Corey's out there in Orlando, the NBA bubble. We talk about the restart, what life in the bubble is like, as well as getting into some of the training ideas that Corey has, some awesome stuff about developing real athleticism, rhythm, relaxation, all that stuff, what it means, what's the difference between output and true athleticism, and how training has helped basketball players improve, if players have improved, if players now are better than players in the 80s and 90s, a great basketball debate. So enjoy that discussion with Corey. Today's episode is brought to you by Raycon. Awesome, awesome wireless earbuds that Raycon sent me. So go check that out. You can go to raycon.com/juglife and save 15% on Raycon's wireless earbuds. That's raycon.com/juglife. So go check them out. Thanks to them for supporting the show. As always, visit jtsstrength.com for all your online coaching needs, powerlifting, power building, weightlifting, AI programs, jujitsu, juggernaut apparel, like our most popular, The Grateful Tea, and all of our books. So thanks for listening. Thanks for subscribing. Enjoy the episode.
I know it's a busy life out there in the bubble for you. Yeah,
it's nuts. I mean, in more ways than one, but it's different going to work. It's another thing living at work.
Uh-huh.
That's where it's different.
So for the uninitiated, you are the director of strength and conditioning for the Phoenix Suns. One of 22 teams there at Disney World for the NBA restart. So you guys just started having scrimmages, what, 2 days ago?
Yeah, I believe it was 2 days ago. Just quick correction, I'm the head strength coach, so I don't even know what that means. But we have three other directors. They do all sorts of great work. But in case it's title sensitive, I'm the head strength coach.
Right. So you get out there, and how many days were you stuck in your room?
So we arrived, had a nice little charter. And then police escorts to get us to the hotel. And then, I mean, it was crazy. As soon as you walk in, you go right into testing, and then testing straight to your room. And then you're basically brought meals, you know, like prison, for about 38 hours, I think, 30, maybe a little bit longer. And so you go through, you got to create two positive tests before they let you out.
You mean two negative tests?
Oh, excuse me, negatives. Yes, excuse me, two negatives. Correct. Two negative tests. So then on the next day, the nurses would come by and test you at your door.
Okay.
And once you produce two negatives, then you're able to come out into a population, if you will.
All right. And then everything is just self-contained to that, to like your one resort in Disney World, or are you?
Yeah, we're. When it first started, you were contained within your specific resorts. And then just a few days ago, they let us go to hotel. So now we can visit all the other hotels, Hang out with other strength coaches, or if you have friends with other teams, you know, you're able to mix and mingle now. So that gets to about 2 weeks of consistent testing every day to weed out anything just in case. And now we're allowed to mix and mingle right when scrimmages started.
And I know it's zero positives inside the bubble thus far, so everything is going according to plan for the NBA. You know, just give kind of what's your reflection so far of what has to be one of the more unique work experiences of your life?
You know, it's the biggest honor of my life to be involved in such a project. I mean, honestly, like, this is history. And it's the only major sport where, like, the whole world is watching. And so it's like, you don't know it, but years later, we're going to look back on this and it's like, man, this could be the most unique experience in all sports.
All right, and I'm definitely looking forward to the 30 for 30 about the NBA bubble.
100%. 100%. But, you know, the world's watching. And for us, it created such a unique dynamic and opportunity for our team internally that, I mean, I think it's probably the best thing that's happened.
So whether you're working, you're flying, you're training, you want to be listening to what you're listening to, not what the person sitting next to you on the plane is listening to, or what the owner of your gym, you know, whatever Kenny G soft rock workout mix he's got going. You want to be listening to what you're listening to. And for that, you're going to need some great wireless earbuds. So before you go dropping hundreds of dollars on a pair, check out the best wireless earbuds from Raycon. They sent me a pair, really been enjoying them. I walk through the grocery store and stuff with them and listening to podcasts, and pretty much wherever I go, I'm listening to something. So Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of other premium wireless earbuds on the market, but they sound just as amazing as other top brands. Their newest model, the Everyday E25, are their best ones yet. With 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design, give you a nice noise isolating fit. Raycon's wireless earbuds are so comfortable, they're perfect for conference calls or binging on podcasts. I'd never used the wireless earbuds before because other brands, they didn't quite fit my ear well. I don't know if I got a weird shaped ear hole or something, but I couldn't get a good seal on them. But the Raycon ones have been a really nice seal, so they cancel out all the other noise. I just listen and hear what I want to hear. So unlike some of your other options, these are stylish and discreet, no dangling wires or stems to distract during calls. And you've heard that the company was co-founded by Ray J, Snoop Dogg, J.R. Smith, and they're obsessed with Raycon, so pick up a pair and see what all the hype is about. Now is the time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off when you go to raycon.com/juglife. That's buyraycon.com/juglife for 15% off Raycon wireless earbuds. buyraycon.com/juglife.
So rewinding, 4 months here, 4.5 months to March 12th, the Jazz game and it gets, Rudy Gobert tests positive and whole NBA shuts down. And that was like, in my estimation, like that was the turning point, not just of sports, but almost of like the entire world. It's like an NBA player has tested positive. It's all shutting down. Things are getting real. So you had no contact for months, right, with any of the players, besides like you could text them and say, hey, you should probably do this in your home gym if you got one.
Right. Yeah, we were able to do some pretty unique things to make sure that the guys held themselves accountable. I mean, look, at the end of the day, they're professionals. Mm-hmm. They should be taking care of themselves. The only issue is, like, what's the context now? You know, like, it's different when you have a facility to go to. It's different when you have a coach that's right beside you saying, yeah, do that, don't do that. And so for them to be completely autonomous, be honest, like, especially if they went through the college, that's probably the only time they've been autonomous.
Yeah,
and so it was quite the challenge, but at the same time, we have such a young team. They're so open to any and everything that we were doing. We did a ton of videos because we didn't want to set up like, all right, here's a Zoom call at noon, everybody be on it, so do our jazzercise. Like, we don't know who's got what, and so we split off our players and we were able to understand their home dynamics and their individual situations. And quite frankly, we got them equipment too. I mean, we took equipment from our own facility just to put it and outfit it in their space so that they're able to do the things we needed them to do. But, you know, from a training perspective, the only things that I cared about was getting some isometrics, some eccentrics, and just do total body lifts through full ranges of motion. And then at that point, we'll add some jump ropes for low-level plyometrics. And then if you got a court at your house, like some dudes do, or some dudes have, full-fledged gyms, they're able to – do some more advanced training, but that's really what those were our big rocks during that very unique time.
Now, did you have guys on your team who they did not have a hoop, access to a hoop for months at a time?
Yeah, believe it or not. I mean, why would you? You know, like if you're a pro,
yeah,
every gym in the world, you know, so why do you need another hoop at home? And when this whole thing broke out, there was a couple of situations where it's like, oh man, yeah, I guess that is weird that you don't have a hoop. But it made sense when there wasn't a pandemic, but now there's a pandemic, it's like, oh, you're an idiot. How are you a professional basketball player without a hoop at your house? So you saw some guys like getting courts set up, and some guys did it big.
Well, and because the first person I remember hearing about that was Giannis. He's like, yeah, it's like, I don't have access to a hoop. And this is the reigning MVP, probably about to be the two-time MVP. And the guy's right. Just, you know, dribbling in his living room or whatever and doing what he can. But that's a trip. And, you know, I'm watching your own training stuff because you were, you know, of the garage gym brotherhood. you know, my garage gym has been kind of I was going to say hot spot, but that's not the right term. No. Popular training location over this time, as you know, I'm working with the NFL guys, and then that gets shut down from the school that we were training at. So I think I had one week in here. My most star-studded week of garage training was had a three different NFL guys. The national record holder, 2016 Olympian for Greece in the shot put, who was in America. Actually, he just moved to Phoenix.
Oh, nice.
I'll have to connect you with him. So he was there training in the garage. A 2018 Olympian for bobsled.
Oh, wow.
In there. Then Marissa, my girlfriend, world champion powerlifter. And then I was very much bringing up the rear at that. But I remember everyone, like our online coaching people, they're trying to get home gyms set up at the start of this, and they're like, oh, every place is sold out, and you know, they're charging, Craigslist is charging $200 for a pair of 45 pound dumbbells. So
yep.
I was like, man, the street price, the street value of dumbbells,
right,
is all-time high,
right? Dude, real talk, gym equipment became drugs, like, yeah. so quick, because, man, I ain't gonna lie, I was high-rolling some people over some kettlebells, for real. Yeah, I was like, you know what, I got a couple extras I don't need, and I was jacking up the price. I was like, why not? They're gonna pay it.
Yeah, supply and demand, you know, this is some basic economic lessons for you people who are ill-prepared with a lack of home gym. You know, so from a training standpoint, you mentioned the kettlebells. I love seeing the stuff that you do with the kettlebells and the contract and relax drills and all that. Talk a little bit about, you know, what the significance of that contract and relax concept is in athletic performance.
Yeah, I think for a lot of us in strength, we all came from like, all right, I'm going to pick this barbell off the ground, big time deadlift, awesome. All right, I'm going to put this bar on my back and give me that one rep max on a squat. Great. The only problem is it's tension, 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 tension. And when you see anything at high velocities, it is not tension, tension, tension. It is the most amount of tension, and then it's spring-loaded and relaxed. And then you just repeat it cyclically. And that was the one thing that you find with other means of velocity-based training, if you will, is it's very concentric-based. And it has the contraction relaxation aspect, but the problem is it's like it never is cyclical. So if you do your trap bar shrugs, or you do your cleans or snatches, don't get me wrong, great lifts, depending, especially like with your training history. But the whole idea of the contraction relaxation for me was, how can I make loaded plyometrics like cyclical? And that's what it came into. It was rhythm, it's coordination, it's everything that you see in sport. And then there's a reactive component. Like, imagine cleans done with decent loads that were truly cyclical. I'm not talking like CrossFit, bang, bang, bang. Like, no, you actually have to receive that load. And then now unilateral, just like you would do in gait, like gait is everything. If your training doesn't reflect on what is happening in gait, then more than likely it's probably not the right training. You know, it has to somehow reflect that in some form or fashion. And so for me, it's the cyclical aspect that actually got the contract relaxation to where you're snapping the eccentric, having a high velocity eccentric, which goes into a slight or to a very quick amortization, and then boom, relaxation, floating, if you will, and then right into the next transition. And so to me, with the kettlebell, it was just making it more athletic, making lifts more athletic, more dynamic. Now I got my upper body doing a transverse movement while my lower body is staying sagittal and vice versa. And when you have that, I mean, to me, it just makes sense because that's what you see in sport.
Yeah. And the comment in there about that rhythm and relaxation, and like, that's what athleticism is. And I think it's so easy for, you know, whether it's an NFL combine and NBA pre-draft combine stuff, strength coaches, wherever they are, it's very simple to understand athleticism as how high, how fast, how far. And but we've all seen numerous examples of, you know, the workout warrior, combine superstar type of person who can run fast and they can jump high, but they can't play the sport necessarily as well as those things would lead someone to believe. And right. Then on the other side of it, the person who doesn't have those fantastic measurables, simply measurable characteristics, but, you know, that they have, they're exceptional at the sport. And of course, technical, tactical things come into play. But, you know, someone who always comes to mind when this topic comes up is like Russell Wilson, you know, because Russell Wilson is extremely elusive, but elusiveness cannot be quantified in the context of a 40-yard dash or a 20-yard shuttle or a vertical jump or broad jump or whatever it is. And there's a story that I've heard him talk about on a podcast or something. And when he was a little kid, that he would go to the mall, and as there was like the crossroads kind of part of the mall where the different lanes converge and everyone's walking in different directions, him and his friends would go from one side and try and race to the other side through the crowd.
Wow.
And you know, they're
that's awesome.
Dodging, dip, dive, dodge.
Right.
You know, through everyone. And it's like, as kind of cute or whatever as that story seems, like that is learning the ability to judge, you know, to because so many of these athletic movements, and we've talked about this with variability and shooting and all that kind of stuff, it's making this nearly instantaneous calculation of, you know, there's this much space, I see the people converging on this space at about this speed, I can make it through there, or I can't make it through there, I need to speed up or slow down or whatever it is. And the rhythm and relaxation part of things, like that is the true athleticism, so much more than just the output qualities of how high you can jump and fast you can run and everything. So I think
I've been in basketball for over 12 years now. And I assure you, my best basketball players on every team never had the highest outputs in the weight room. Not a single one. It's never happened. Quite frank, the exact opposite occurred. And so when I say that, yeah, like I care about output. I care about stress response adaptations, progressive overload, all this stuff. But when it comes down to making the best athletes better, if I don't find the lifts that can actually do that or that will complement what they are naturally good at and what actually makes them good innately in sport, then what are we doing? So when I first started these contract relaxation techniques a few years ago, my best athletes, the ones that actually put the ball in the hole, picked it up faster than anybody else because they understood the dynamics of, okay, I have an implement. I have to adjust my body. I have to self-organize instantaneously. All the things that you were talking about. And it's not from a neck down standpoint. It's from a neck up standpoint. Mm-hmm. And they just use their physicalness or their body from the neck down to self-organize to get the task done. It's totally different than just gripping and ripping. You know, it's totally different than just straining through something under a large time under tension. And that's what's the beauty of it is the guys that are actually good in sport innately are good at those lifts. Man, that's to me no other correlation I need. At that point, it's like, yeah, let's progressively overload this. And then with that being said, there's levels to the contraction relaxation. All right, let's take, for example, the kettlebell splits, right? So basically, I take a kettlebell and I drop it. As I'm dropping it, I catch it at the last second. I split, so AKA a lunge, and then I throw it back up in the air and just keep it cyclical. Now with that, you're looking down on it, right? You remember playing basketball when a kid? You dribble the ball the first time. You stare at the ball as you dribble it, right? Okay, now there's levels. Once you get accustomed to that, okay, eyes ahead. Don't look down at the basketball while you dribble it. Same thing with the self-passing. Don't look at the kettlebell now. And then that adds another layer. And then, okay, now we have some other things. And I'm not saying I'm standing in front of them saying look left and right. But, yeah, look at different places in the room as you're going through this. Okay, as you go, as you drop it down, look to the left, bang. Look to the right, bang. And next thing you know, you're picking up certain subtleties that are happening. They're aware of their space in sport. And that's where, man, like, I wish we can get away from these outputs. I say it in podcasts lately. Outputs justify us as strength coaches because it's our way of having an objective number to say, I did my job. And I get that. But, man, like, we're just doing it to rob the resources of the athletes so they can get better at sport. And that's what I have a problem with. When you see these one rep maxes, they test every 3 weeks for the one rep max, or they test every week on, you know, sprints or jumps. And it's like, dude, you know how much resources it takes to do that? And you're just now just taking those resources away from them where they could have got better at sport and they could have allocated those resources to get better from a motor coordination standpoint or something that's actually transferable. You know, that's where I have a problem.
I don't know what diagnostic would be needed though for you to have a test of unconscious competence in the kettlebell drop lunge.
You drop the bell. Yeah. There it is. The bell drops. Oh, it hit the ground? Yeah, you suck. Yeah. You know what I mean? Hey, like, all right, let's put a time on it. You got it for a minute. Go. How many can you get in a minute? And then let's add layers to it. I love it. Let's throw a heart rate strap on you. Let's see your efficiency. Let's see your capacity to do this. Are you at such a heightened state to just for you to complete this task, you're at 180 because you're like, you're so uncomfortable. You don't know what to do. Like, oh my God. Or you've had some experience with it. You understand contraction and relaxation. You're able to transition smooth. And all of a sudden your heart rate's around 7 or 110, you know, 120. It's like, okay. Like we're not as such heightened state. So I can progressively overload this. I just take a metric in a different sense. And now I've come to the ultimate goal, which is efficiency.
So this all kind of brings me to another topic. And I sent you that podcast probably a couple months ago now. And it was Bill Simmons and I can't remember who he was talking with, but they were talking about how players have improved. And so the Last Dance, I think, was kind of the launching point of this, which, you know, mid-pandemic was probably the biggest thing going on in basketball, certainly.
Biggest thing going on in the world. It was amazing. Yeah.
And it brought up so many of these discussions of like, you know, oh, could so-and-so play in today's era, or could Steph Curry play in the 90s because of how physical it was, and then, you know, are players better? And basketball, I think, is one of the only sports, it seems, where there's arguments made for people who were playing 20, 30, 40 years ago and like, oh, they're actually better, like an apples to apples better than current players, where, you know, I don't think really anyone thinks that, you know, if you took Patrick Mahomes and put him in 1985, they're like, yes, this would be like an alien came down.
Right.
But basketball seems to be a bit different in that sense. And Michael Jordan, I think, is a clear like line of delineation in the physical training part of basketball, that he was, you know, maybe the first guy to start lifting weights. And certainly from the clips I've seen of it, he's not doing contract and relax drills. He's just kind of going for a pump more than anything else.
Right.
And I remember, you know, seeing that stuff and thinking about it, I was like, yeah, okay, they talked about him becoming stronger. I was like, but could Michael Jordan in 1988, like pre-lifting, was he jumping higher and running faster than he was,
yes,
you know, in 92? And how then someone like Steph Curry, like, yes, he's definitely better, but that's like all technical, tactical. aspect compared to Del Curry, you know, let's say, the most straight up comparison possible there. And it's like, when a sport is so, success is so driven on technical, tactical qualities, like how does the physical training aspect of things compare, and how does, you know, AAU culture come in that, you know, Michael Jordan, staying with that example, like, well, he was a baseball player too, and you know, he was playing pickup basketball and all this different stuff that doesn't seem to me as an outsider in the basketball world to exist, certainly to the same level that it would have, you know, 2020 as it did in 1980. You know, as you see the progress of the athletes in your 12 years, you know, working with basketball players and then playing basketball, I know before that, give me your impressions of how players are improving, why they're improving, if they actually really are improving.
Right. It's a hard question to answer because everything is so interdependent. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, like you brought up, there is the technical and tactical aspect. Well, now the three-point line is everything from an analytics standpoint. So now analytics really change the game, where it's like, dude, just try to outscore people. I mean, look at the Houston Rockets, right? Like, you're just trying to outscore people. And so when you have, like, and then you see other organizations who just go extremely big. I mean, their point guard is 6'7", 6'8". And then you're like, and that's the smallest
coach. Two nights ago.
Right, yep, exactly.
Point guard.
Exactly. And so it's so hard to understand. It's like, well, was it because of physical training that it did X, Y, and Z, or was it that skill? In my opinion, throughout the years, from youth to professional, I believe they became more skillful. I believe in today's game, they were more skillful earlier. And then I would say, like, the later game or the earlier game, it was more physically demanding. Absolutely, 100%. But I would say, because there is, you know, just like in football, when there's rule changes, there's tactic changes. Same thing with this. Like, you know, at one point, you know, you couldn't inbound the ball from the baseline over the backboard. They used to do that because Will Chamberlain, all they did was just throw it over the backboard and he would just go dunk it. Inbounds play, great. Also, they used to be able to jump over the free throw line. Will Chamberlain would do the same thing. He would do his free throw like a layup. He would just jump from the free throw line. They're like, oh, we can't do that rule no more. So you understand, like, there was so many changes in the game. Of course, there's going to be change in technical aspects, tactical aspects.
Probably brought about half those.
Half those changes, 100%, man. 100%. That dude was amazing. In more ways than one.
Yeah, his track and field stuff at Kansas. Dude was like a 60-foot shot putter and a 7-foot high jumper or something, like combination.
He might be the best human to ever walk this earth. And, like I said earlier, in more ways than one. But as far as, like, from what I've seen in my short career, I mean, it's only 12 years. That's a very small snippet. But the game has changed so drastically within that time, where I think the younger athletes are a ton more skillful. Obviously because of AAU circuits, but it's also exposure. You know, they've got exposed to these skill sets. They got exposed to, you know, YouTube videos, to all these elite camps. And, you know, they start them so early now. They start them so early.
The YouTube video one, and just the proliferation and ease of video technology, I think it makes such a huge difference in these highly technical sports. So, you know, my background is track and field through the shot put from when I was 8 to 23. Mm-hmm. And so I retired from throwing in 2010. Even then, YouTube was maybe a year old, 2 years old. So, like, into my college career, throwing at the University of California, Berkeley, like, we would go on this website called Mac Throw Video, and you had to, like, download these, you know, .wmv files and stuff, and, like, watching these grainy shot put videos from the 80s and maybe something's in slow motion, or literally buying, like, you could order these flip books of technique, like, that were framed.
Wow.
Flip book to see the technique. And the best shot putter my senior year of high school is threw like 60 768 feet, something like that. Now, every year, high school shot putting, there's 3-4 guys throwing over that, multiple 70-footers, which used to be just this, you know, incredible gold standard. And I think a lot of it can be attributed to, you know, now they can just click on YouTube and see Ryan Krauser and Joe Kovacs and Tom Walsh, the best throwers in the world, in 4K, super slow motion, and then they can film themselves and, you know, go on Adobe Premiere and line them up next to each other and
right,
or whatever app they're using. And I would think for basketball, from like the technique standpoint of like shooting technique, you know, you go back in the 80s and see like a guy, we all know those dudes, whether it's playing pickup or whatever, and they have that like goofy shooting technique, like some kind of behind the head, right. You know, but they're just
Bill Carr, right?
Yeah, and they're just getting buckets like that. But now, like, everyone's got a nice shot, you know, save for like Alonzo Ball, Markel Fultz type of situation. Like, everyone's got pretty much that, you know, very like textbook good shot because they could see it easily, and then they could set their camera up and watch themselves do it. So I think like those kind of more like conformed technical ideas are so much better. But do you think that when you're talking about like earlier players and the physicality of it being more demanding, do you think that there was a big benefit to those guys playing 80s, 90s basketball, that they may have grown up more as like multi-sport athletes or high variability in playing, you know, pickup, like outdoor pickup, where that's
right,
as big a deal now?
Well, there's two ways to look at that. One is, and me and my director Bove talk about it all the time, is that the fragility aspect, right? Like those 80s and 90s guys, I mean, I'm sure they weren't in a bubble per se, like kids are now these days. So, and they also played in terrible shoe technology compared to what they got now. So there's a fragility aspect to it. And most of those guys, I mean, you hear stories about how Charles Barkley grew up and how, I mean, you go through any type of, you know, JUCO or you know, like Scottie Pippen's route, like it's pretty impressive. Dennis Rodman, his route, you know, I mean, it's, you saw it on The Last Dance. Like some of these ways to the top, if you will, it was anti-fragility, you know. And so there's this like environmental aspect that made sense during that time. That's where I'm like, I don't know if you could have those players in each other's era. It'd be totally different. And I don't think it would be both successful outcomes. I think it has a shot, but not. It just doesn't make sense to me. You can't really apples and apples it. It truly is apples to oranges in that respect. But as far as like the like going back to the youth, I mean, for me it was the N1 mixtapes. That's all I cared about, man. I swear to God, that's the only reason why I started playing basketball, because I thought that looked so cool. And so I go to Foot Locker, and that's where they had them. Right, like you actually buy them on VHS, and me and my boys, we would just watch it and rewatch it, and like, oh, I gotta try that move. And so that's what I think it's more of now.
Who was your guy? What's that? Half man, half amazing, Professor.
Oh, no, well, Professor, like we can pull it throughout the whole like, he's white thing, but I can't just gravitate. I mean, like,
obviously, my favorite guy was Escalade, so
Escalade, right? No, I think I mean, Hot Sauce is pretty nice, man. Like, Hot Sauce is kind of my guy, but we would, it's the exploration aspect, you know, like I just wanted to attempt those skills and then I became more skillful at it. Just the same as these kids watching, you know, your Kyrie Irvings, your Steph Currys. I mean, I want to shoot the 3-2 if I was 10 years old, even though if I can't get the ball to the rim, but they figure it out. And all of a sudden they make that shot, which is, can be robotic and all arm action. These kids are now launching it.
Yeah.
So they're becoming little shot putters. And they're learning to finesse it with a total body. And as they get older, it becomes easier. So it's like, man, maybe that is a good idea. You know, like these are things you got to think of, because if it's true.
I remember when we were at breakfast, we were talking about, I think one of your friends who had, you know, figured, okay, my kid's going to be this tall, so I'm changing the
height. Right.
Because there's an argument to be made that changing that shot technique when you're a little kid, like, is actually maybe damaging long term, but you're saying that, you know, an argument for the other side as well, that it's like a variability kind of.
Yeah. Well, the only way, if you watch a little kid try to shoot on a rim he doesn't belong on, he doesn't do it sagittal.
Yeah.
Man, he gets into rotation. And then all of a sudden he's developing these nice rotary aspects to launching. Oh man, that's gonna be a good little shot putter one day, maybe, you know, or a little discus guy.
I saw some clip on Instagram, and they said it was a Patrick Mahomes, like, you know, 8 years old playing basketball, and he goes from beyond the beyond half court and stops and just one arm chucks this thing and makes it from three quarters court. And I was like, well, sign them up. Sign up. You
know? That's awesome. But like, that's where I think there's no, like, people always want the recipe for, like, when I become a dad one day, I know I'm going to be like, okay, at age, you know, 3 months to 8 months, he's got to be able to accomplish this and then just go up. But I don't, at the end of the day, I don't think there's a right way. I mean, there's some definitely wrong ways, but I don't think there's a right way. I think you just put them in an environment of exploration and they'll gravitate to whatever that meets that need. But as long as you have an environment with variability to allow them to access different, I think you got it, man. I think they'll just lead to that sense. And then more importantly, like, get them out of a bubble. I mean, I know I'm in one right now, so it's kind of hard to say that, but like, get them out of this, like, fragile state where everything's going to hurt them. Like, they need to skin some knees and fall down some hills, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I mean, I think from the basketball standpoint, the Nerf door hoop to the Fisher Price to the driveway hoop, and it's kind of slanted, and there's a car parked on. So, you know, I played that, like, no one would look at me and think I was a basketball player, but I play AAU through junior high, and I was playing every day from when I was 5 years old in our driveway, three car driveway, but we always had a car parked on the one side. So like, you had to play around the car, and it was like a 9'8" hoop, and it's got dead spots on the backboard, and the wind's blowing, and my dad's hitting sky hooks in the corner, you know, and you're trying to do like dream shake and kind of fade like underneath like the awning or like the
right the, it could be too high, but
to hit the little baseline jumpers and stuff, and practicing outdoors and playing indoors and all that stuff. And I think that is such a quality for people, and this extends, you know, hopefully for people listening, like, this extends so far beyond basketball. This is you know, soccer players who, they don't just play on their club soccer team. They play futsal, and they play, you know, and they're just kicking it against the wall and the racquetball and playing it off of two walls or three walls, or, you know, baseball players who play baseball and stickball and softball and everything in between. Like, there's so much value in all of that stuff from the long-term development side of things.
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the biggest is being able to change the goal height. Like, I was lucky that my mom made it happen for me. She got me that really cool goal that you just grab a handle from the back and you can lower it and heighten it, and it was all perfect. So honestly, like, in the summertime, yeah, that thing was at 8 foot all the time, because we're all trying to punch it.
Dunk contest.
It was always a dunk contest. And they talk about, that's exploration at the highest outputs that you can create.
Yeah.
Right. At youth ages on pavement. So, like, I think you're going to be all right later when you go to hardwood surfaces and there's a 10-foot goal. And you're like, But I will say this, from a skill standpoint, I wasn't that good of a shooter. Probably for that reason. Didn't put enough time in on an actual 10-foot goal.
That stuff's crazy, too, you know, when we're talking about output and rhythm and coordination and variability and all that stuff is – so often when you see these really high output athletes, they seem to be lacking the rhythm, coordination, you know, above the neck feel for things. But it's not like there's anything that the two are not mutually exclusive.
Right.
So we have a guy who competes for our weightlifting team. You may have seen him on Instagram. His name is James Townsend. Young Tony is his Instagram. Mm-hmm. James is the most powerful athlete I have ever been around. That's including, you know, Dwayne Chambers, a European record in the 100 meters, as NFL players, whatever. James Townsend, 36 years old, 420-pound power clean, 43-inch vertical any day of the week, warm-up, whatever, doesn't matter. He ran a 10.3 200 in high school, 4.30 40 at his pro day, you know, was a practice squad, practice, like 11.5 broad jump, plus he benches like 450. in one day a couple months ago, he power snatched 325 pounds and then benched 325 for 10.
That's unbelievable. I don't
think anyone else in the world can do that at 200 pounds body weight. But,
he's a legit alien.
Yeah. And you know, we could get into the long-term development discussion with his daughters, and now his wife's pregnant with the son too, so I know he's pumped about that. But
man, there's some stuff going there then.
But you know, I look at James, and he was a practice squad receiver for the Bears and didn't catch on, and it's like, all right, well, if you look on paper how big he is, strong he is, fast he is, how could this guy not be the best player ever? Now,
right.
But when I think about someone, the James Townsends of the world, the few that there are, those guys who have all the track speed and all the combine stuff, the knock on them almost every time is, well, they don't have any wiggle, or they don't have any moves, they're not good route runners. And mm-hmm. I'd imagine, and talking to James like this, he kind of verifies this, that when he was a little kid, he was the fastest. So, you know, playing Pop Warner football, I was like, James, here's a toss. Get to the sideline, you know, turn the corner and run up the sideline. And then he got in high school, and it's like, all right, well, you know, here's a jet sweep, or just run a streak, because you don't need any routes. Right, you know, and right. In college, you can still probably kind of do the same thing to a large degree. But then as the athleticism gap narrows with the higher level, and I remember seeing a guy we played against in high school basketball. He was 6'5". He was doing, like, I saw him do 540 dunk in warm-ups. But, you know,
right.
Well, he couldn't barely make a layup, but
right.
Would, like, spin back door and reverse dunk on the thing. But he didn't have those skills. And it's, do you think it kind of becomes a thing of, like, the nurture part of it? They don't have to nurture those skills because the nature part of it is so overwhelming.
So I think it's always this case where – and you had a great examples all the way through, but honestly, like, why would they need other skills if they could get the job done with just physical raw output? And this is something I've seen in strength, and especially at the collegiate level my entire career, where you have, man, this guy's a great athlete, but man, he sits beside me, you know, on the bench. That's not good.
Yeah.
Like, he's the strongest guy. Why isn't he on the court? Well, because none of that matters. The weakest guy is actually the one out there on the court. There's a reason for it. Some of those people, this is what they had to do. They had to develop, and they had to find their way to have success. If all your success is determined on physical output, you will always end up short. You will always end up short because there's the small intangibles that you can't put a metric on that will allow you to be a better, skillful athlete at whatever you do. I've seen it my entire career, and there's nothing, honestly, if you see that early in development, immediately grab that kid and put him in a harder situation.
Yeah.
Immediately. Do not make the game easy. Put them in levels higher, or get them under some very skillful coaches. You got to make their environment harder immediately. If not, why would they don't need to access new skills. Why? I just do X, Y, and Z and done.
Yeah.
That's what you have to foster those kids more so than the kids who suck. Kids who suck, like, good luck. Like, yeah, go get in the weight room and get some physical outputs, and maybe you'll have like a couple of points here and there, or maybe you can go get some rebounds, kid. You know, great. You know, maybe you can box out real nice, set a nice screen for the guy who's actually good. But those other kids,
let's not hate shoot them at the screens. That was kind of my specialty, bud.
But yeah, you got to put those kids in more advanced programs,
yeah,
as quick as possible.
I think it takes a coach or a dad or whatever with such foresight to be able to see, like, it doesn't matter that you're the best 9-year-old or 10-year-old. We got to take a step back to set you up for the longer term success. I think like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar could be a great example of this, because when he was, for some amount of his career, and I know like his freshman year at UCLA, dunking was not allowed. Like, that was just not, right. It was against the rules. So even though I'm sure he could have just been cashing, turn and dunk on everyone in the world, it forced him into developing this more skilled game. And then mm-hmm. when they're like, okay, well, now you're allowed to dunk too, he's like, oh, well, that's easy. I'll just do that too. But
I can do that.
Yeah.
Well, what I think's amazing is looking at those high output athletes that found a way. Mm-hmm. So a great example is Vince Carter. That guy had more physical output than anybody else on the planet. And he had just enough skill to get him into the league. And then all of a sudden that guy had one of the longest careers because he developed it. He shot that thing.
Yeah.
I mean, those physical outputs went down with age, obviously, unless he got on some stuff. But like then he just became a super skillful athlete. He's like, okay, you know what? I'm going to use my brain. I'm going to have this nice shot. And then I will always have value. And it's, man, like he's my favorite example because he is such the spectrum. And high physical output guys can get there. It's almost like you got to give them inhibition. You got to get them to turn off so they can actually develop skill and develop touch and develop finesse. But like, good luck. Like more than likely, you're gonna have to have age take that one away from you.
And I think it is that those guys who can start transitioning to the skill game before the decline of the physicality, because it's always like the understanding of the game is gonna trend up and the physicality is gonna trend down. But the guys who can make that middle section longer, you know, I think LeBron's a great example of that because he could. He's a monster. He could. Of just been, well, I'm just going to run everyone over. And would he have been very, very good? For sure. But that gap between very, very good and, you know, one of the best ever, I think is so much on that idea of letting the skill catch up. And I think that's why a guy like Kevin Durant, when they're saying, oh, how's he going to be coming back from this Achilles injury? And it's like, he's got the perfect setup to be – to have like the great old man game or whatever. Like, it doesn't need to be predicated on physicality. He can just stand out there and shoot and be 7 feet tall and still going to get a shot up over everyone. Where, you know, if tomorrow, like a John Morant tore his Achilles, you know, God forbid, it'd be like, oh, this is going to be a tough hit for him to transition his game to the old man game.
Well, like, to bring this home as far as, like, from a training perspective, that's why I give them what they don't have. Like, I see this so much where strength coaches get that big, strong guy, and guess what they do? They do everything to make him bigger and stronger. And it's like, dude, the big, strong guy couldn't catch an egg if you threw it to him. They're just, you know, and it's like, what are we doing? Like, does he really need to get bigger and stronger? No. Okay, you got that one guy who – super physical output but can't stick it or land it. Yeah, that dude needs to own relative body weight strength. Like, this guy might need to get some load on him just to understand, I gotta slow down. I gotta build a suspension system for my car and maybe like tap the brakes, not just hold on the brakes. You know, like, I mean, guys like that, they just pull the e-brake, you know what I mean, just to come to a stop. And you're just like, man, you ain't gonna last. There's no way with those forces. There's no way. So give them what they don't have. Compliment them with some other things, but give them what they don't have, and that's going to hopefully round them out if they're not getting it in the sport itself.
Perfect. Well, Corey, thank you so much for taking the time, buddy.
No worries.
The Suns, all the luck in the bubble and good health and all of that. I'm looking forward to more water aerobics videos from you. More golf videos.
Hopefully, man. I hope I can get some time because I'm actually falling in love with it, low-key.
Nice, man. Well, next time, either if I'm in Arizona or next time you're in Orange County, let's play.
I'll bring about 12 balls.
They can follow you at Schles Strength, right?
Yep, Schles Strength.
All right, buddy. Well, thank you so much for the time. Good luck out there, man.
All right, appreciate you, Chad.
All righty.